This is the bigger. This is the Bigger Pockets Podcast, show 214.
You know, they want to list and they have to list and sell their home before they can buy ours. We'll step in and make them an offer and say, listen, I mean, if you want to buy the property that we have to sell, we'll buy yours. And so we sort of facilitate a lot of deals that way.
You're listening to Bigger Pockets Radio, simplifying real estate for investors large and small. If you're here looking to learn about real estate investing without all the hype, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and be sure to join the millions of others who have benefited from BiggerPockets.com, your home for real estate investing online.
What's going on, everybody? This is Josh Dorkin, host of the Bigger Pockets Podcast, here with my co-host, Mr. Brandon Turner. What's going on, Brandon?
Josh Dorkin, how are you?
I'm doing okay, man. Doing okay.
Good, you know, good.
Living life, enjoying this lovely gloomy day that we have here in Denver.
Yeah, it kind of looks like I'm looking at your window that looks like Washington.
It does. Nice. It's a little unusual, but you know, that's all good.
Well, you're a little unusual. Well, you know, it fits.
Welcome back from Canada. I'm just going to ignore your comments.
No problem. Yeah, Canada. Yeah, I'm back. We're back in the States. However, we are talking to a Canadian today.
Ironic, isn't it?
Yeah, a boot Canada. Is that a bad Canadian accent?
Well, no, I mean, we're talking about
U.S.
Yeah. Investing in the U.S. Yep. So,
yeah,
and this is a show for everybody because it's not like specific to, hey, here's issues that a Canadian's going to have buying in the States. It's, you know, hey, here's what this guy's doing, how he's doing it. And it's interesting. He's definitely, raising the bar a little bit, huh?
Yeah, definitely is. I like his whole, like, I don't know, perspective on think bigger. Like, he's like, I could go buy a house or I could put together a $30 million fund to buy houses, you know, like, yeah, very cool stuff.
Yeah, so it's great. It's great. Cool. Well, before we get into the show, why don't we do today's
quick tip?
All right. Today's quick tip. We are hiring here at Bigger Pockets. We have, we've got a couple jobs, but by the time this episode comes out, those jobs will likely be filled. We're hiring engineers. We're hiring all sorts of other folks. If you are looking for a job at an amazing company, go to biggerpockets.com/jobs and see what's up there. You can check it regularly. We update it. Like I said, we have 5 positions open right now, and that is likely to change. But go to biggerpockets.com/jobs, and maybe you will get a job here at Bigger Pockets.
You might.
Remember when you had to pay to get a lead's phone number? It was like the dark ages. Until Deal Machine made skip tracing a thing of the past. Now, with your Deal Machine plan, you'll get unlimited access to phone numbers and contact information for no extra cost. That's right, get high-quality, reliable information trusted by leading financial institutions, all fully compliant with the federal Do Not Call list. Explore over 150 data points, including age, gender, marital status, occupation, and a ton more. Trust me, this is the data you need for off-market deals. With new filters, people flags, and color-coded phone numbers, lead management just got a ton easier. Ready to step up your investing game? Sign up for a Deal Machine plan today and gain immediate access to this unlimited treasure trove of contact information and phone numbers. Just head to dealmachine.com/BP. Transform your lead generation and deal-making strategies with Deal Machine. Sign up today and start exploring the unlimited possibilities at dealmachine.com/BP.
You might think you want real estate, but that's not true. What you really want is passive income. With new investors struggling to find deals or get enough money to buy them and veteran landlords tired of the constant tenant phone calls, is there a better alternative? Actually, there is. Short notes from Connect Invest. Connect Invest is an online investing platform that allows you to easily participate in passive real estate investing, and all you need is $500 to start. Short Notes collectively funds a diversified portfolio of commercial and residential real estate projects across acquisition, construction, and development phases. You'll earn a fixed monthly income without the hassle of owning or managing real estate. Head to connectinvest.com/BP to create your account. Fund your digital wallet with at least $500. Select from 6, 12, and 24-month short notes with annualized return rates up to 9%. Then sit back and let your monthly returns roll in. Join today by visiting connectinvest.com/VP. Connectinvest.com/VP. What's better than low money down? No money down. Now through Rent to Retirement, you can buy a brand new construction turnkey rental property for no money down. Wait, hold on. This can't be right. I need to double check with Zach, Rent to Retirement CEO.
Oh, hey, Rob.
Zach, how the heck are you selling turnkey rental properties for $0 down?
It's not that complicated, Rob. Rent to Retirement has new construction properties up to $20,000 below retail prices. We also have investor loans with rates as low as 3.99% and down payment options as low as 5% or sometimes even zero money down. You get all the cash flow, appreciation, and equity for as little as zero money down. That's an infinite return.
Oh, wait, let me get on this before we tell it to the whole Bigger Pockets audience.
Just head to renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com or text REI to 33777. That's REI to 33777 to learn more about how you can get started investing with no money down today.
Get your next new construction property at a steep discount or invest with no money down. Head to renttoretirement.com today.
All right, guys, today's show is show 214 of the Bigger Pockets podcast, and you can check out the show notes at biggerpockets.com/show214. Today's guest is Joel Sherlock. All right, Joel's a real estate investor turned agent. He's got a focus on fix and flips and income properties. He does live up in Canada, but does, you know, has been doing the what sounds like the bulk of his investing down in the States. Lots and lots of great information. And, you know, he's, as Brandon said earlier, I mean, he's gone out and kind of raised the game here. He's one of his first deals was this, you know, whopper. Well, it wasn't a deal, but he put together this big fund and started finding lots and lots of deals. Fascinating stuff, really interesting. Again, another perspective different than all the others that we've had on the show, and hopefully we keep doing that. But let's bring him out here and hear a little bit more about his story and what he's doing. So, all right, Joel, welcome to the show, man. It's good to have you here.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So we've not had a lot of Canadians here on the show. In fact, I'm not sure if we've had any, but you do
you invest- just lost your entire audience.
Well, you invest in, you do more, you do American stuff as well, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So just people listening to this don't have to be like, oh, well, it's Canadian. I'm not going to listen. I won't learn anything. I think we're going to learn a lot from you. That is my hope anyway. So,
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so. So cool. Well, welcome. And why don't we start where we like to start a lot of times. How did you get involved with real estate investing?
Yeah. So, I mean, going way back, I'm a finance student and big numbers guy. And then, of course, as you know, you come out of high school and then it was like, well, do you buy or rent? Run the numbers and you buy. But at the time, I had a credit card with some room on it and not a lot of money. So a friend and I bought a pretty terrible one bedroom den apartment and then put a small little reno in it. And, you know, we sort of split that and it, you know, it was, we called it a two bedroom, but it wasn't quite. And then he met a girl 6 months in and first year of college for me and said, hey, I'm in love and I'm going to move in with her. Like, you should buy me out. And I said, well, let me just check the couch and see how that's going to work. But, you know, we put it up on the market and we bought it for $89,000, put about $4,000 into it and then put it on the market 6 months later and sold it for $145,000.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, at the time I was in school and I'm like, what a pain. And, you know, this is terrible. And so I went and bought a unit in the same building, one floor down, two bedroom this time. And I was going to reno it and just have a roommate and no one was ever going to, you know, now it's going to be mine and this wouldn't happen again.
Sure.
But as soon as that one was done, I thought, hey, wait a minute. I wonder if I could sell this one. And, you know, going to school, doing my securities degree. So I like to be a stockbroker. And, you know, everyone's telling me that for the first couple of years, I'm going to get yelled at, make $30,000 a year and get people coffee. And I'm going, well, I just made double that flipping two houses. That was kind of fun. I'm going to try that for a while. So, you know, as the projects got larger, you know, the banks in Canada are a little more conservative. So they wanted me to have a job. And I said, well, I have a job. I'm flipping houses. So ended up in the car business, for a while, just because it allowed me to make good revenue and come and go as I please. And, you know, I was racing BMW cars at the time. So I went to work for them and, it was a lot of fun, but, you know, met a lot of people and, you know, working with my realtors, you know, I'd show up in a suit in our market. They can be a little more casual at times and it really frustrated me. So I got into the business with one of my realtors at the time. And I started a brokerage in like an independent brokerage in the Okanagan area, which is like Canada's Napa. And I did that before I was licensed, which for anyone listening, that is the wrong way to do it.
So you started a real estate brokerage
with my realtor.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Interesting.
With my realtor. So I put some money in. We started the brokerage, you know, got the branding together, started to put the systems in place. And then I raced through my real estate course as quick as I can so that I could start making some money on the sales side. So you know, and we started that business in 07 in the Canadian market. So, you know, that was it. Luckily for me, I had sold some property that I owned to sort of fund my transition. and I'd sold it at a very good time. And then, but, you know, learned the real estate sales business at the very bottom.
Okay. Okay. So, I've never actually heard everybody did that, right? So they opened the brokerage and then got the license.
Totally wrong.
But I mean, I don't think it's illegal to do that. I mean, cause you had your partner, was the broker, right? So it's not
100%.
Right. So,
yeah. And then we had a 915. So like a licensed broker on staff as well, and compliance and accountants and you name it.
So, I mean, I don't think it's a bit unusual, but I don't think it's a horrible thing. Do you regret that?
Absolutely not. Okay, no, perfect. I mean, it was definitely, it was an expensive way to learn the business for sure.
Sure.
Yeah. And, you know, subsequently I've sold that brokerage 4 years ago, as we started to get more active in the United States.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Nice. Get more active in the U.S. Sure. Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, so
why do that, by the way?
That's a good question.
And we sort of stumbled into it. So, you know, from my soiree in the BMW world, I met a lot of really incredible people, doctors, lawyers. And, you know, as the Canadians were coming down in droves to buy real estate in, you know, Arizona or Florida or, you know, those depressed markets, a couple of surgeons were going down, friends of mine, and they were going to golf. And I thought, hey, it's a little gray here. I'll come down, look at some real estate, and we'll golf and maybe have a beer or two. And it was mind-boggling to me. The first trip we went down, we were through 75 houses, and you know, we're talking about last sale was 715, and you know, mortgage balance of 680, and you know, it's listed at 350, and we're talking about a $200,000 offer. And the numbers to me were just mind-boggling. I mean, I'd never seen anything like that, but. Then when we learned a little bit more about it, I'm going, well, hold on. For a Canadian, looking at that, I'm going, well, hold on. What's a rental market look like here? And if someone gave me that lot next door, could we replace what's here for that price? No, you couldn't. So, you know, at the peak, that market was taking a ton of starts. It was huge demand. And then it slipped quite a bit. So, you know, we put a thesis together and just came back to see, you know, we're going to buy some property and the market will come back. I don't know when. And in the meantime, we'll make some great rental returns. And, so we put a fund together of $32 million and then went back down. And, yeah. So, you know, in a very standard like GP LP structure from the finance world, you know, the thesis worked very well. And we put a lot, you know, I put some money in and a couple of our managing partners put some big cash in too.
So you're like, I mean, I love this because
I mean, it's pretty bold, right?
Yeah, right. It's like, hey, I want to go buy a property. I mean, most people think I'm going to go buy a couple of properties. Maybe I'll go flip a little house, right? You're like, I'm going to put together a $30 million fund. I mean,
so in the initial side, you know, I didn't know what the appetite would be. I thought, you know, we can probably get to 10, 15 million and come and, you know, spend some cash in the area and get some great returns. But, you know, we never really, it was huge demand. Because it was just on the tip of everyone's tongue. And in Western Canada, everyone was going to Arizona. And, you know, in Eastern Canada, Toronto, Winnipeg, Montreal, like they were going down to Florida. And, you know, it worked out really well for us. We met some great people and, you know, we had some really, really incredible connections down there. So, you know, we raised some money, went and spent it, started getting good returns, and then more money came in. And so from the real estate investment work that we were doing in Canada, we met so many people who wanted to participate down there, but didn't necessarily know how to get access to it or how to put it together. So, you know, it was an incredible ride. And now, you know, we're divesting ourselves of all those assets now. We've got about 14, 15 doors left. And, you know, we've made some good returns on just the currency alone.
Okay. So let me back up a little bit and get kind of an overall picture of what we're talking about here partially because
I want to know more about what we actually ended up doing with the 39.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm thinking like, first of all, what is a fund? For the people who have no idea, when you say you built a fund, what does that mean? And then what did you go in and buy? And let's go there.
So it's just like it's a big pool of capital.
Okay.
You know, so we came back into basically it was everyone that we were talking to, like coming out of the finance world and partnering with a real estate guy. And, you know, so I was selling real estate and then we were also flipping houses and we were working with investors and we'd been involved in some private financing up here. So, you know, I'm again, with that background on the finance side, I'm very comfortable with those kind of structures and joint venture agreements and, you know, private lending, et cetera. So when we came back, you know, we had a very conservative business model and, you know, that the rates and returns and basically we had a management team down there, property managers, maintenance guys, pool guys, rehab teams. And you know, it was just, hey, like invest with us. We'll go down and participate in this market and we can all split, you know, the management will be ours. The rehabs will be ours to manage. And then, you know, we'll give you this hurdle rate. And then everything above that hurdle rate, we took a trailing interest on.
What do you mean hurdle rate? What does that mean?
So basically it was like the investors made 8%.
Okay.
And then everything above that, we participated in.
Okay, cool. So yeah, I know it's kind of how a lot of syndications work. You know, like if I'm gonna go buy an apartment complex, you know, I'll give a preferred rate, 8% to the investors. And then after that, we'll split everything, you know, 70, 30 or whatever.
Totally.
And so very similar there. I mean, again, I love that.
You talk about your business model. You said you had a conservative business model. So what does that mean exactly? You know, somebody's listening, they're like, I don't even know what is it?
I mean, so I look at it as conservative because in Canada, we're buying houses at like $400,000 and we're adding a suite in a basement for 25, 30, 40 grand, depending on the area. And then we're getting, you know, 1500 to 1600 upstairs and 1100 downstairs. Right. Yeah. And we're looking at homes in Scottsdale where it's like $80,000 for a 2-bedroom, you know, like walk up sort of Melrose Place style development. And then, you know, $4,000 to rehab it and we can get $1,200 for it. So for me, I'm going, well, okay, I can buy one of these in Canada or I could buy three of those down there or four.
Yeah. So is that?
Yeah. Like the cap rates were just a lot stronger. Plus I saw, you know, a huge uptick coming in that market, just had no idea when.
So was the intention of the 30 million to go and buy lots of these? Is that kind of what the plan was?
Yeah, essentially, like we put some cash in, started buying, and then we went back out to our networks up here and just said, hey, you know, who wants to come and play ball with us down? And it, the between BC and Alberta or like Calgary, which was a, you know, an oil town and doing very well at the time, it was far more than we ever expected. And so, you know, we had four partners on that fund, if you will. And one of them was a private mortgage finance guy that I'd worked with before. And so he had some really, really big ties into some big capital.
So what do you do with that? You go down to the States and now what?
Initially, like we just had really good relationships with brokers and, you know, we would get great deals. But then, you know, as the banks started to parcel things and, you know, you're buying things on auction steps or we're getting auction lists and, you know, you have somebody run out and, you know, we had a gal on staff who would just get the auction list and go to every property she can and look in the windows and, okay, that one's missing appliances, or she said, I'm at 123 Maple Street and it has a pool. It doesn't say pool in the listing. So we would know, okay, that's one we're buying for sure. And, you know, it as the volumes came up, it got a lot harder to find deals, you know, and then the management of it, you know, the market down there, the rental market did very, very well for us. And then most of the currency we brought across at par or, you know, a dollar and change. And then now we get $1.32 to $1.37 on the way out.
Oh, so a little currency arbitrage in the middle of it all, huh?
That was a nice little, icing on the cake.
Yeah. So what was the intent? Was this a buy and hold fund or was this a repositioning? What exactly were you looking to do?
Yeah, it was a sort of buy, improve, and then resell when the market came back. And, you know, in the meantime, it was, hey, we'll make some great rental returns.
I mean, essentially what you're doing is what all the hedge funds were doing, right? So like, I mean, like these big hedge funds were coming to the like markets all across the US, buy a bunch, 100%. Hold them for a few years and sell them.
Yeah. So had a tiny little hedge fund.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how many deals did you do in that time period with that fund?
So that we had about 214 doors.
Okay. Was that all condos, single family, multi, all sorts?
Bit of both. You know, our mindset, we didn't want to be more than 20 minutes out of Scottsdale.
Okay.
Just, you know, for that team, you know, if we needed the pool guy over here, the maintenance guy over there, the property manager had showings. And, you know, again, when you looked at those sales numbers, the farther you got out, if you got out into like Litchfield Park or, you know, Surprise or some of those areas out, the price is just, they sort of, on the uptakes came up slower. And then when things slowed down, they fell off way faster. So for us, it was just 20 minutes. You know, we liked newer inventory or things that we could add some good value to at a pretty inexpensive price. Cause that was the other side of it. Like renos in Canada versus reno costs down there. What I can get done for 12 grand in Arizona is night and day to up here in Canada.
What do you mean? I mean, why is that? So you're saying it's more expensive in Canada to get stuff done?
Yeah.
Why is that? I mean, just, cost of living higher?
I don't know. You know what? I'm not sure. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's good to know. I watch it. Stay away from Canada. Just kidding.
Wow.
All right. So what'd you ask Josh?
Safe market. You know, we got a good solid lending here and you know, nice conservative returns, but no, both have been brilliant markets for us. That was a really exciting project.
Okay.
So why Scottsdale?
Frankly, it was a nice place to go and visit. And we had a lot of people, the demand there was huge. You know, when I went down for that first trip, I'd kind of gone down because we'd had a lot of clients who had gone down and got a deal buying second residences for themselves. And, you know, we'd had some people who'd gone down and didn't get a deal. And so we just thought, like, we had so many people asking me about it. I thought, you know, might as well go down, play some golf and get some sun and figure this thing out so that we, at least we can point people in the right direction.
That's cool. Nice. And I love the idea that you just, you know, you picked a market, you find out what was working there, and then you just went all in. You bought a bunch of stuff in that area. You know, I just love that bigger thinking.
Well, and you know, yeah. And we looked at Florida. We looked at, you know, we've seen lots and lots of deals, and it's just, it wasn't a market we knew. It wasn't a market we had connections in. It wasn't a market that we had people in. And, you know, and that's where I love, you know, Bigger Pockets is amazing for that. Cause I mean, it's so quick to connect with people who are doing it in, you know, they are invested in flipping homes in this market, and you can ask questions and people are really open to it. So
yeah
I'm very thankful for you guys putting that resource together for us.
Thank you. No, that's great. That's great. So, okay. You're this guy, you start by, you know, buying an apartment with your buddy and turning it into this little thing, and you make some money, and then you say, hey, I'm going to go build a fund. What follows? What follows after this $30 million fund?
Yeah. I mean, you know what? I was a cog in the $30 million wheel, and it was a very exciting time for me. I mean, I really wish I had put more capital in. You know, going back, I should have sold everything I had in Canada and put it all in there, but I didn't. Sure. You know, I still buy, fix, and flip. I've got a phenomenal business partner up here who's a luxury builder. So, you know, I go out, find the deals, you know, we plan them together, and then I hand the keys over to her. She does the reno. I go find the next deal. Yeah. She does a phenomenal job and keeps us on budget much, much better than I, which is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And then we manage the sale. And then, yeah, so I'm just kind of out finding deals, and we plan it together, and she does all the build and management.
All right. So what are you doing to find deals today? And in this market, obviously it's changed a little bit the last few years, probably since the fund. So what are you doing to find deals?
Yeah. You know what? We have a lot of innovative strategies. You know, like I write a ton of handwritten personal notes and we leave those in doors. You know, I find that they work so much better than a printed thing.
Yeah.
You know, instead of, yeah.
So you find a deal, you walk up and, well, you find a property that looks like it could use some work, and you'll leave a handwritten note.
And then, you know, recently I was in New York last week, and I met the guys at Bond, which have like little machines that write handwritten notes.
I've heard of that.
I was like, yes, this is amazing. Because, you know, for me, I'll get 100 of those printed up. And if there's an area, you know, especially if there's an area where we just sold a house, we'll go and put a note in every single door. And I find that the handwritten notes they get us so much more phone calls back. And that's where we get to really talk to people about, you know, what we do, how the deals work, and, you know, what kind of money we can offer them, and sort of how much value we'll have to put into that house to really get to the sale prices and really just explain, you know, what it needs to look like for us to make money. And a lot of people, you know, it doesn't work for everyone. But, yeah, you know, we've found a lot of deals that way. We've also traded a lot of deals.
Really?
So, awesome. Like, we'll put deals out, you know, on our listings when we have a finished product. You know, we'll let everybody know, and at the open houses, we're very open about it, that if you have a home that needs renos, you know, we'll buy your home if you buy this one.
Interesting.
And that's been really successful for us. So, you know, basically we find a buyer for the home we're in, and we find our next project at the same time.
Walk me through that. Maybe I'm tired or something. Like, give me a hypothetical situation. Brandon's, you know, got a property. You're you. How does this work?
So open house agents are there. You know, it's one of the guys from our team, and all the guys, you know, people come in and they go, oh, this is so beautiful. And they go, well, where's your home? And they're, oh, you know, we live in the area. Oh, really? Well, what's the address? Well, we'll go and look at it. And if it's something that, you know, they want to list and they have to list and sell their home before they can buy ours, we'll step in and make them an offer and say, listen, I mean, if you want to buy the property that we have to sell, we'll buy yours. And so we sort of facilitate a lot of deals that way.
Interesting.
Yeah, I've not heard anybody doing that, but it's clever. I like that.
Yeah.
And you're also an agent still, right?
I am also, yeah. So I'm still an agent, and then we still have our team in the Kelowna market.
So yeah. I'm assuming you can say, you know, they come to your open house or you meet them or whatever, even if the deal doesn't work out in terms of you guys don't want to buy it to flip or whatever, you could still offer to then list it for them as well.
100%. Yeah. So. And it's a great, lead tool for our agents, and they love them. You know, I don't list our projects. There's some challenges with that in the Canadian marketplace. So I always have one of the other guys on our team list it. And then we spend good money to advertise those listings. And, you know, we really push those open houses. So there's great traffic. It's a great lead source for the agent, but it's also been a great lead source to get deals and to find our next deals.
Nice. Okay. Nice. So, so how, I want to go back a drop here. How do you find deals at scale? So, you know, you've got take the fund. I mean, obviously, you know, you've got a fair amount of money. You can't just, you know, buy a $30,000 house once a year. You need to be buying at a respectable pace.
Yep.
So how do you go about doing that in a market?
To be honest, I don't know if we could remake that now. And we've had a lot of talks about it. And the reason we're selling those assets and sort of reinvesting in commercial now is just because we can't find deals on that scale anymore. You know, that I think that was a very unique time in the Scottsdale, Arizona market. You know, and the banks coming out with big blocks, and we could go through and go, okay, we'll take those seven and we're going to
pass them. This was like 08, 09 then you're talking about?
Yeah. So 8, 9, and 10 is when we were spending.
Sure.
Yeah. Got and then we've been selling for a year and a half.
And I think, you know, it's probably Scottsdale is probably not, you know, you're not going to do that there. But I mean, I know guys right now that are doing the exact same fund thing in Florida. They got a big fund and they're buying.
Love to talk to them.
Right, yeah. Dozens of properties. Totally. I'll totally connect to you. Yeah. They're doing like, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of deals they're looking at in Florida. And they, you know, they just find a market, find a niche that works there. And then they put together a fund and they're making it work. And I've heard of guys doing that in other cities as well. And so, you know, it might, even if you guys, you know, people listening to this might be interested in buying at a little bit larger scale. Somewhere, you know, if one area is booked out, maybe find another one. Where are people doing it?
And the interesting part, I mean, you know, it was a mentor of mine who was involved with us. You know, he'd always tell me, he's like, Joel, it's exactly the same thing. There's just more zeros.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, that makes sense. But, you know, it's the same analysis on each property. It's the same, you know, analysis on the market. You know, we always look at job growth and, you know, population growth and unemployment rates and just to make sure there's a good stream of tenants coming in and also a good stream of new buyers coming in.
I love that.
Nice. Nice.
So, you know, but before we do an episode of the podcast here, we always have our guests fill out like a little questionnaire. And we just say, is there anything specifically you think you'd like to talk about? And so, Joel, you wrote on yours, as I was reading it, you said, our foolproof inspection strategy to get fixed price bids from our contractors, less surprises, more profits.
I love that.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
There's sort of two pronged. When we're closing on a property, like when we get a property under contract, we'll set out a 4-hour window for, you know, our inspection and to have our trades come through. But by the time, so we book that, the owners are out. We are, you know, we don't have earnest money up yet. Like, you know, we still have conditions on this or subjects on the sale, as we say in Canada.
Okay.
But basically we've done our rough budgets and then, you know, we'll have our painter come in, we'll have our drywaller come in, we'll have our HVAC guy come in. Like basically there'll be a team of like 16 people in that house and they're all firming up their quotes.
Wow, that's awesome.
So, you know, I mean, and the reason we set that up is, you know, one time we had a large, you know, it was a 4,000 square foot house and it had a 12-12 pitch on the roof. And so, you know, I just thought, okay, roof, that many square feet, good, go, let's do it. And, you know, when we started to get the quotes back from the roofers, as soon as they got there, the majority of them said, no, we're not doing it because, you know, you have to clip in and it takes them a lot longer and there's a lot more safety things and they need racks and pulleys and all these, and I mean, I had no idea. So, you know, those kind of surprises can throw off a budget so quickly. So for us, we were really focused on just, you know, how do we minimize that? Again, for me, and I'm a systems guy. So anytime we make a mistake, it's like, how do we put something in place so that we never do that again?
Yeah.
I've never made any mistakes. I've just invested heavily in my education.
Nice. Oh, I like that. I like that.
That's how I at least sleep at night when you have those silly things that we should have caught.
So, I love that. I mean, so you're basically saying like, yeah, I mean like, so I get a property under contract and what most people do, including myself, and I'm sure Josh too, like when you put a property under contract, usually I'll do an inspection with the inspector, will come over and then I'll buy the property and then I'll start getting in bids to come in. But at that point it's too late. You've already bought the property. It's already too late. You can't back out. Right. So you're saying, I mean, do the work up front to get the guys in during the inspection period. So it's not just the house inspector. It's all the bids you can possibly fit into that hour or 4-hour window. I love that. I've never done that, but I'm doing that.
We usually put like a 2-week clause period in there. And then the first week is planning. We're going out this many square feet. You know, what's the flooring guy going to come in at? And then once he has his rough quote in, we're like, great, Thursday, 12 to 4, we need you on site to firm up this number. Yeah. And then Friday we'll remove subjects and you know.
So how do you do that? I mean, given that so many of these guys are so flaky, obviously you found a good team of people, but like, you know, getting them to commit in that period. And I ask this primarily from like, you know, somebody who's trying to do this the first time who hasn't done a lot of deals, like having that confidence to kind of go and convince these guys that, yeah, I'm going to be a great investor to work with, but you know, I want you to do something that most people don't do. This is very different. And so I don't know, what advice do you have on that?
Well, oftentimes, I mean, you know, a lot of the trades guys, and for sure it's trial and error. Some guys will just blow those appointments and not show up, and we just won't call them on the next time. But, you know, for us, we've worked with a couple, we've made those errors. But I do find, you know, if you're clear in your communication and like, we only have the house for these 4 hours. And so it has to be during those 4 hours. And we really, you know, you do have to stress that. We usually call them the day prior and confirm it with them, but they're also looking to sell their services as well. So, you know, that we usually have their attention on that, but you know, it certainly with scale, that's really helped us, you know, cause now we have a bit more of a consistent team, and you know, the flooring guys know that we'll be doing more jobs in the future, or the drywall guys. And, you know, so that has helped, but in the beginning it was just a lot of handholding, you know, check-in calls, follow-up calls the day prior, and just reminding them that we only have a 12-hour or 4-hour window, and just letting them know, like, if you don't get in these 4 hours, you won't get the job.
That's great.
Because
yeah, great advice. Yeah.
When you get people, if you're like, hey, can you come over sometime to take a bid, you know, bid on this project? I mean, that's something I know, just thinking aloud here. Like, I do that.
I'll come in 3 weeks.
Yep. Can you come over in sometime in the next couple of weeks to come look at this property? Sure. And then 2 weeks later, it's like, hey, you never made it yet. Oh yeah, I'm going to get over there still. Okay. Well, how about next week? You know, like, hey, we've got 4 hours. If you want the job, you have to be here during these 4 hours. Exactly. They will make it there. I love that tip.
Well, at least the good ones will, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And we also do it. And for us, you know, if somebody doesn't show, you know, then we haven't given them any money. And so if they don't show, we've sort of weeded them out before we write them a check, and then they disappear, you know.
Well, that's that's fantastic.
Yeah. And well, we do the same thing with closings as well, in tenanted properties and things that we're buying to hold. You know, we'll set the closing up for, you know, the 27th of a month. And then on the 15th, we'll book it for 4 hours and a very similar thing. So we can run ads on the property. We clear that with the current owner. And then we have a bunch of tenants come through so that we close on it on the 27th. And then it's fully rented already on the 1st.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love the efficiency in that. That's very cool.
We're always looking for ways to improve, searching for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for better is by matching with quality candidates. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BiggerPockets. Just go to Indeed.com/BiggerPockets right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Indeed.com/BiggerPockets. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes to help you see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes you like, so you can find a home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours even on the same day with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to help you get the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today. Listen up, business owners, because I've got some quick little math for you. Fewer costs equal more profit. The problem? You're spending more than ever on operations, materials, deliveries, software, and more. So why not reduce your costs and headaches with NetSuite by Oracle? NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Oh, also, NetSuite lives in the cloud, which means you can reduce IT costs with no hardware required. Cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because now you've got one unified business management suite. You can improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. It makes sense that over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. So don't let rising costs sink your business growth. And by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/biggerpockets. NetSuite.com/biggerpockets. NetSuite.com/biggerpockets.
So moving on a little bit, you mentioned that you're getting into commercial. Can we talk about that? Like, what are you doing with that right now?
Commercial, especially in Canada, well, in BC in particular, the laws on the tenant side in BC certainly favor the tenant. In commercial, they're a lot more, you know, fair and equitable. And we've also just been able to find, again, larger deals. You know, we don't have to find 200 deals. You know, we can buy shopping malls, or, you know, we can redevelop some pieces, or, you know, look at development sites or land deals, and, you know, just larger ticket items, which has been really great. But also on the tenant side, you know, we find that it's just a smoother process, right? You know, you can have a tenant in there for 10, 15 years, no problem.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. I had a buddy this weekend I was talking to who's a commercial broker down in like the Nashville, Tennessee area. And he's like, why aren't there more people on Bigger Pockets doing commercial, even small stuff? And I didn't really have a great answer for him. I was just kind of like, it's just not what a lot of people do. I was like, maybe it's not a lot of writers writing about it. Maybe we don't have enough Bigger Pockets bloggers that are blogging about it. And so, I'm recruiting him in. He's going to start blogging for us. But I mean, there are some definite advantages.
It's happening.
Yeah, it's right? Yeah. So why don't we, you know, like why don't more newbies or people get into, maybe not newbies, just investors? Why do we all avoid commercial?
I mean, there's more cash up front without a doubt. Okay. But, you know, once you get a few, you know, the banks also prefer commercial, right? You know, I got a 5-year lease with a 5-year renew, and it's to like a bank or Starbucks or, you know, whatever that would be. Yeah. That's like gold to them. Yeah. Right. You know, so one of the challenges we had was, you know, as you started to build the investment portfolio, you know, then all of a sudden the bank starts giving you pressure on, oh, how many mortgages we have. Okay. You know, to get past sort of 7 or 8 became a bit of a challenge. And then to get into your 20s became a bit of a challenge, where on the commercial side, you know, they look at you like, okay, you're a commercial landlord, and they're a lot more flexible. But to get started in it, you know, if we hadn't have made those returns that we did on some of those flips, the private equity fund and, you know, those things, I wouldn't have had the capital to get in.
Okay, that makes sense.
So you threw a lot at him. You talked about malls and redevelopment, and I mean, it sounds like you've done lots of stuff. So maybe you can walk us through just a couple small examples of some of the commercial stuff you've done.
Yeah, so I mean, the big thing for us is downside risk management. You know, so what's the possibility of having a large vacancy? You know, so we look at a lot of deals. We analyze a ton of deals. And it's always through exactly the same spreadsheets. And, you know, we sort of build them out and vacancy risk. And, you know, so we've looked at shopping malls. We've looked at development deals. We've looked at some multifamily pieces. But again, you know, we want to be in a market that has good population growth. You know, shopping malls, I'm sort of torn, like looking at the way people are shopping now and the growth of Amazon and all of that. And, you know, what's the strip mall future? But they can still be very, very good investments. And, you know, you got a lot of security when you have those anchor tenants on either side. And then you really make the money off the smaller businesses in the center.
Unless they go out of business, which is happening left and right.
Yeah. Our mall here in Aberdeen, Washington, where I live, I mean, it's the creepiest mall because you walk through it. And it was at one time a big, huge mall. But right now there's like 4 stores left in it. Both anchor tenants are gone. I think both. Maybe the Sears is still there. But there's probably 200 to 300 stores and there's 4 left. So you walk through it and it's just like, there's like tumbleweed blowing and there's just garbage around.
That's horrible.
It's a weird, creepy kind of place to be,
that's happening all over the country.
Yeah,
too,
it is.
Yep. Yeah. It's an interesting place, but somebody just bought it for pennies on the dollar. I should have even, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I just heard a story last week about somebody buying, you know, this $100 million mall for like, you know, thousands of dollars. It's just crazy. Well, tell me, Joel. So, I mean, it sounds like you're talking in hypothetical, like you're evaluating a lot of these deals, but what types of commercial properties are you actually buying or have you bought?
So we do say no to most. I mean, you know, we've bought a couple multifamilies, you know, 8 units, 16 units. I love those. They're just very hard to find in Western Canada for reasonable cap rates without getting too far outside of our area. So that's really where I would like to go. But, you know, we did get into a couple malls, smaller strip malls in good growth areas. And then we've done a couple private lending deals in the development world. So, you know, where we've come in as a partner on the land. And then the great part for us is we can help them develop their sales strategy and exit the property once finished too.
Let's talk about those small strip malls for a second, because I don't think I know we had Joel Owens talking about triple net, but I don't know that we've
beautiful
done a show necessarily where we've really covered strip malls specifically. So what are the economics of a strip mall? How do you kind of make a decision on, how do you evaluate that differently than potentially a multi or something else? What are you looking for?
So really what we're focused on that side is like possibilities of big vacancies, you know? So if there are two big box stores on either side, you know, those can be safe, but you want to look at, well, Target, for instance, was a huge, you know, came into Canada, massive, massive expansion plans, and then subsequently, shortly turned around and pulled right back out.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you, one of your 40,000 square foot tenants all of a sudden leaves, that could be detrimental to the entire investment. However, Target was backed by, you know, that lease into Canada on some cases, you know, was backed by the parent company. So then that gives you a ton of security.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, it's looking at all of those, but triple net is really the reason that we started going into commercial, purely because, you know, if property taxes go up, their lease goes up. If operating costs, you know, we can put a management fee on top, you know, it's just everything is totally, totally separate. So it's more consistent cap rates, and frankly, they're better cap rates.
So can you talk about the numbers on one of these just so we have an idea?
Yeah, actually, I'd be happy to do too, if you want, is I can put one of our spreadsheets at the bottom of, you know, I can actually share the numbers and just, it's totally open book. I'll just black out the addresses.
That'd be awesome too. Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, give us, you know, something, one of these projects. Yeah,
so, I mean, what we'll look at is each individual strata unit will come in, and then we'll put a different, you know, if it's a hair salon or something that's got a 12 cap on it, you know, we might put a higher vacancy rate on that unit in comparison to, you know, the $8 a square foot we're getting from the big box guy at the end or something along those lines. So really it's an analysis of each of the businesses individually, and then we combine it all into one unit.
Interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So how do you, I mean, this is a much bigger question that we're not going to be able to dive fully into, but like, how do you begin analyzing a commercial deal? Like, I mean, in terms
of, you analyze thousands of residential deals.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you like kind of get, know what you're doing, and then you add kind of things in there.
Yeah. I mean, really, again, you know, you come back to like downside risk management, right? I mean, you know, what's, you know, but again, it's very, very similar. Like we just closed on a warehouse here, which, you know, has an interesting use and a great cap rate, but that's exactly the same. We go out and look at how much space is available and how much future potential, like strip malls as well, right? I mean, if there's 7 other malls that are getting developed and there's going to be a whole bunch of commercial property coming out, that's a huge negative on that. You know, now there's a whole bunch more competition coming out of the market. Okay, we don't want to do that deal.
You said interesting use also. What was that? What does that mean?
So, you know, we had a welding company in one of our buildings, and they just really, it was a bad tenant. So we ended up exiting that company, and, you know, we had an ad out $10 a square foot, and we got an offer for 12. I thought that's interesting negotiating. And they had a license to grow cannabis, which is federally legal in Canada, which is interesting. So yeah, we ended up bringing that tenant on, which was a new soiree for me. I learned a lot. Like, ask me about wine, I can tell you a lot. I unfortunately didn't know a lot about that.
Interesting. I mean, so what is the Canada rule on that? I mean, like you said, it's federally legal. So you can't, you guys don't have states, right? So
province. I mean,
provinces, like, is it providential? So
it's medically legal in every province.
Okay. Medically. Okay. Yeah. So it's kind of like the US, you know, where most states have, not most, but a lot have medical, and some have just you know, recreational. Open.
Recreational. Yeah. So, I mean, the thing is for us, like we call the governing body and we check those guys' licenses, and then they have security that they have to put together. And, you know, it's an option agreement. So, you know, they ultimately will buy the company or buy the building from us, because Canada is unique where, you know, there are publicly traded companies worth over $1 billion in the cannabis sector, like Canopy Growth. So it's quite a different landscape up here. Like in the US, we've looked at it, but there's the federal illegality, the new president coming in, you know, the last thing that's downside risk management right there. Like the possibility of maybe losing a building. No, thank you. You know, that's the beauty of real estate, is it can't be taken away.
It's interesting. The Denver, I know the Denver market, you know, at least well enough to be dangerous at this point. And, you know, when everything became legalized here, all the old warehouse space around town, you know, just started exploding, and rents went up double, triple, quadruple. It was crazy. It's crazy. I mean, you know, is it good for Colorado? Yeah, sure. It's good for Colorado. Is it good for landlords? Sure. It's good for landlords. I mean, it's been fascinating to see the city grow as a result of all this money flowing into different parts of the city that really were fading.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, and we looked at a number of buildings in Colorado, and I'd actually taken a couple trips down and looked around, but anything that spikes up that fast, it just so reminiscent for us of like Fort McMurray, which is an oil town here, you know, in northern Alberta where the oil sands are. And, you know, oil is a cyclical market for sure. And the challenge that we look at, you know, can you get, you know, at times they had double wide trailers that were selling for $500,000 and they were leased out at, you know, like $4,200 a month. And I'm going, okay, but when oil, not if, when oil does this again, you know, then who wants to be in Fort McMurray? And, you know, not a lot of people. It's not the same amount of people that live there when oil's booming. So that kind of risk is just, you know, even if you can get a great cap rate 50% of the time, you know, it can be sexy and attractive, but, you know, all of a sudden you get a couple zeros on there and that just throws off the entire return.
Yeah. Hey, Joel, how are you financing all this stuff at this point? Like, what is this, your company actually look like today?
So closing out that private equity fund, right, which was like a GP and LP structure, you know, traditional, like a private equity fund, if you will. And then we do a lot of joint ventures with those partners just because we've worked together, and, you know, any deal that we do, we have some skin in the game. But certainly, you know, we're proven earners now to those people. And so we've got a lot of access to capital, which has really allowed us to just grow the business for sure. You know, the last 5 years have been incredibly exciting. But again, it's the same fundamentals. We just spend less time now looking for cash.
Are those people funding the down payment and then you're using a bank traditional financing for the rest, or are they funding the entire purchase price, like almost like they are the bank?
So, you know, sometimes it's a hybrid of both, but usually, especially in Canada right now, we've got mortgage rates on the residential side at 2.9. So, you know, of course, the structure is always, you know, we might buy it, reno it, and then refi it and get the cash out without a doubt. Yeah. Okay.
Very cool.
Cool.
All right. Kind of last question before we head to the fire round. What are your future plans for your business? Like, where's it headed?
You know what? It's again, I still love, like, I absolutely love the demo part of rehabbing property. So I don't think I'd ever get away from that. You know, my RRSP or like my 401k is real estate. And I like the longevity and security of commercial. So, you know, keep building that. That's a lot more passive income. It's not as active or as much fun as, you know, going to find a deal and planning out a reno and smashing it down and redeveloping it. We are looking at a couple development pieces here. We got a beautiful lake. So there's a lot of scarcity of land. And so, you know, the beauty of that is we're looking at a couple development pieces there. So really, I just love looking at these deals. And so continuing to look at deals and do ones that make sense and learning. I mean, I'm addicted to it.
Cool. Love it.
Very cool.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right. Well, hey, let's shift gears here and head over to the world famous fire round.
It's time for the fire round.
All right, let's get to the fire round. These questions, of course, come direct out of the Bigger Pockets forums, which you can get to at biggerpockets.com/forums. All right, the world famous fire round. These questions come direct out of the Bigger Pockets forums, and we're going to fire them at you right now. Number one, I got $100,000 to begin investing. Am I stupid to consider skipping the small deals and beginning with a larger multifamily or commercial property?
It depends on the market. You know, again, look at population. If you can get in at a reasonable rate on a multifamily, you know, then you're diversifying, right? You know, that way, if you only have one property and that tenant leaves, you get zero. If you have four properties and one tenant leaves, you still have 75% of your revenue. So if you can, you know, again, I don't know what market that's in and what multifamily costs, but if you can get into multifamily, I would highly recommend it.
Okay.
Perfect. All right. What's the best strategy for bringing inherited residential tenants up to market rent?
Don't.
Keep them. You think keep them if they're low?
No. Don't inherit a tenant. Don't inherit a tenant. Yeah. It's always been a headache for us. So now, you know, we'll always leave that to the current landlord to deal with, to pay the fees. So we purchase vacant.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Unless now, if they're at good rates, right, we'll actually take the new tenant and actually run them through before we remove subjects. We run them through our own analysis and, you know, take a look at how many late payments they've had. You know, we'll look at potentially pulling credit and checking on those things.
Fascinating. That's very cool. Yeah. When I think of most of my most difficult tenants I've ever had, they're all almost inherited. Always inherited. Yep. Because once they're trained wrong.
Well, and especially if, you know, if they've been in the property and they're paying $1,200 and then, you know, you're the mean guy who's come in and said, hey, you know, we got up this to 15 or, you know, even if you get them to agree to it, which, you know, there's a lot of rental laws here that of how much we can put that out. And it just so, yeah, vacant, vacant possession. Yeah.
Right. I like it.
There you go.
All right, number three, I have the opportunity to buy a retail commercial property, but it has three rental units upstairs. Will it be hard to find good tenants?
Depending on the market, depending on what the vacancy rate looks like in there. But if they're unique properties, we've done really well with those sort of mixed use commercial on the front. I love it. And then, you know, if it's a funky loft style piece on the roof, you know, I really like the unique rental properties that, you know, you can kind of control the market and, you know, you're not competing with that sort of, it's a two bedroom and den condo. Looks like every single other one.
Yeah.
Makes sense. A little advantage, right? And there's disadvantages in that only specific people want those potentially when the time comes to sell. But yeah. All right. Last question. How do other agents balance their time between being an agent and growing their own real estate? It's something I struggle with a lot. If I'm working on my agent business, I'm not really working on my investing and vice versa. So where's the balance from one agent to you?
I color block my calendar. And there's a little thing that these guys put out called a productivity planner. Simple. And it's paper and pen. And I, you know, again, in the morning, I just map out like the top three things of my day. And so, you know, if we've just exited a property or if we're looking to close a deal, you know, then that's a priority. And I just need to put it in there and make time for it. Because, you know, on the agent side, you can be reactionary all day, every day, as busy as you want. But, you know, we got to be purposeful and really focus the time and make sure we're getting to the highest and best use of that time, which for me, you know, is making sure I'm planning for that retirement. And
Yeah, I know a lot of agents who, you know, have been agents for 10 years and they still don't even, you know, they don't own a single property. They've just been so busy with building their agent business and keeping that steady. They never take time to look in their future. So.
But you know, it's such an active income, right? And it's a brilliant, like I absolutely love the real estate sales world,
sure.
But you know, as soon as you stop selling, you stop making money. So yeah, diversify.
There you go. I love it. All right. Well, hey, before we get out of here, let's go to our world famous
four.
All right, Joel. So number one, what is your favorite real estate related book?
Oh, I'm in the process of writing one, so I don't think it can be mine.
Yeah. No, it can't be yours. That's cool.
No, it can't be mine. You know what? The Millionaire Real Estate Agent.
Okay.
And Shift. Cool. Shift was brilliant too. Yeah.
Right on.
Both Gary Keller, by the way.
Yes. Yep. Yes. Yes.
Good stuff.
All right, cool. Favorite business book?
Ooh, favorite business book. There's a couple. You know, Napoleon Hill, anything by Napoleon's been great. I really like The Saint, The Surfer, and The CEO, Robin Sharma.
I haven't
read it. Great book.
I don't know that one.
More so about like balance in work. I struggle with that for sure. You know, nice. I can just put my head down and be crazy focused on work. And I love what I do. But, you know, you got to make sure there's time for family, friends, relationships, and all that. Yeah.
Excellent. Cool. What about hobbies? What do you do for fun outside of real estate?
I love to travel for sure. Love wine. Snowboard in the winter, wake surf in the summer. So yeah, really anything outdoors. I mean, I'm just in the office and on the phone so much that anytime I can put that down, and we got a beautiful backyard here, you know, like definitely very clean four seasons. Summer is summer, winter is winter. Yeah. So yeah, just getting outside.
Awesome. Cool.
All right, my last question of the day, Joel, what do you think sets apart successful real estate investors from those who give up, fail, or never get started?
Getting started is definitely the key. You know, he's like, yeah, you don't have to be great to start, but you have to start to be great.
Ooh,
but,
I like that.
You know, start with a plan.
Yeah.
Start with a plan and look at like, how could this go wrong? And what can I put in place to protect myself?
Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
Interesting. That's great.
Let's start.
That's great. Cool. Start. Yeah. Hey, before we let you go, where can people find out more about you?
So track me down on the real estate side is sherlockandassociates.ca. And then our matching platform that talks about, you know, when we were matching our deals to our found deals, is househarmony.com.
So it's awesome. Like a dating site for people.
Like a dating site
stuff.
For real estate deals. Yeah.
That's cool.
Very cool. Very yep. cool. Well, Joel, thank you so much for coming on. Lots of luck to you going forward and we appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
All right, guys. That was Joel Sherlock. Big thanks to Joel for coming on the show. Interesting stuff, huh?
Yeah, very cool. I like his, again, I like the thinking big. I like the, you know, let's not buy one property, let's buy a whole bunch of them, 200 and some doors. You know, I like his picking the markets. I mean, I just think some solid advice there.
Yeah, that's great. It's great. So definitely interesting. Not for everybody, obviously. You know, I think, you know, going after the big stuff is, you know, potentially you need to have a little more knowledge, right? You've got to understand finance a little better. You have to understand real estate a little bit better before you start to get into that stuff. But, you know, hey, listen, hopefully you guys all learned something and it was cool to have another Canadian on the show.
Yeah, it is always good to have our brothers from the North.
Yes, of course. Awesome. Well, cool, guys. Thank you so much for listening. This is show 215. If you've got any questions for Joel, jump on the show notes at biggerpockets.com/show215. And I don't know, Brandon, you got anything else or we good to go?
I think we're probably good to go. Do you feel my voice getting a little scratchy here? I think I'm coming down
tired.
With something.
You're sounding tired.
Yeah, it could be like yelling a lot this weekend or it could just be like I'm getting sick. I don't know.
Well, I don't feel know. Better.
Thank you, Josh.
Why don't you take us out of here?
All right. Well, for the Bigger Pockets Podcast, my name is Brandon. And this is Josh.
Signing off.
You're listening to Bigger Pockets Radio, simplifying real estate for investors large and small. If you're here looking to learn about real estate investing without all the hype, you're in the right place. Be sure to join the millions of others who have benefited from BiggerPockets.com, your home for real estate investing online.
All right, guys, today's show 24. Why do I feel so cheesy?
There's a reason small multifamily investing is so popular in the Bigger Pockets community. With just a 3.5% down payment, you can own up to 4 different units. Think about it. If you house hack and live in one of the units, you still have 3 different groups of tenants helping you pay down your mortgage every month. 4 kitchens and bathrooms you could renovate to increase your property value. 4 different Airbnbs, medium-term rentals, or other rental strategies that you can try in one property, all in just one transaction. Of course, the question is, where do you find a small multifamily property that you can actually afford? Which market and which deals are best for you? Once you close, how do you manage it, optimize it, keep scaling, and living your life without being tied down to 4 leaky toilets or 4 fussy tenants? All great questions, my friends. All to be answered in the upcoming Small Multifamily Bootcamp with Chris Lopez and Leka Devatha. So if you're serious about growing your portfolio with this highly efficient strategy, head to biggerpockets.com/4, FOUR, today and join us in the Small Multifamily Bootcamp. See you there.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only.
Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all hosts and participant opinions are their own.
Investment in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose.
Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.